Let's continue our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired word by opening to the book of 1 Kings, chapter number 18, where we're going to start again at verse number 20 to remind ourselves of the story we had to end on last session. We have 3.5 years of drought and famine that took place under the ministry of Elijah the prophet in northern Israel. Southern Judah, they're fine. They're getting all the rain they need. But northern Israel has been worshiping the thunder and lightning god Baal and the grain and fertility goddess of Asherah under the leadership of Ahab and Jezebel. And so God turns off the water, turns off the harvest for 3.5 years in order to get their attention. And so Elijah is now back for the climactic contest to demonstrate that God is the real deal. 1 Kings chapter number 18, verse 20. Ahab sent to all the people of Israel and gathered the prophets together at Mount Carmel. That's where God wants them. That's where Elijah is gathering them, near the worship site that had been used by the true believers when they were cut off from the southern kingdom and the temple. So Elijah came near to all the people and he said, "How long will you go limping between two different opinions?" And that's a reference to this dancing that they do during their pagan worship. "If he who is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him." And the people did not answer him a word. And I'm sure that's because they were concerned that there would be reprisals from King Ahab and specifically Jezebel if they were to suddenly go along with Elijah. Elijah said to the people, I only am left a prophet of he who is, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. Now, he's not the only prophet in northern Israel, but he's the only one that's out free and moving about. His point is, Baal's got 450 people speaking up on his behalf professionally. Asherah's got 400 speaking up on her behalf professionally. So here come the contest rules. And this is all from God through Elijah. "Let two bulls be given to us. Let them choose one bull for themselves, cut it in pieces, and lay it on the wood, but put no fire on it. I'll prepare the other bull and lay it on the wood and put no fire on it. You call upon the name of your God. I'll call upon the name of he who is, and the God who answers by fire, he is God." And all the people answered, "It is well spoken." So this is going to be a contest regarding who can send fire from the sky to burn up the sacrifice. Now, on two specific occasions previous to this, many centuries earlier, mind you, for the first one and over a century for the most recent one, God has done this. He sent fire from the sky to inaugurate the tabernacle under Moses, and he did the same thing in the time of Solomon to inaugurate the temple at Jerusalem. So God has done this before, but not in the sight of any of these people. Now, Baal has never done it for any of these guys. They have probably grabbed some fire from a lightning strike somewhere and counted that as Baal's fire, but they're the ones that have been taking that fire and putting it to the sacrifices they put on their altars. So the rules are, though, both sides have to do it at this site, and they have to wait until their God sends fire directly on their sacrifice. If that doesn't happen, then he's not God. The people say that that sounds like a fair deal to them. And I'm sure that that made the leaders of the Baal worship a little bit nervous, because they've never seen this happen before. Elijah's not nervous because he knows God can do this. Verse number 25. Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, "Choose for yourselves one bull and prepare it first for your many, and then call upon the name of your God and put no fire on it." So he is making sure that the deck is stacked completely against himself and against God. He gives them the opportunity to go first. He gives them the chance to choose which bull. So this will keep them from claiming later, "Well, you got the better bull. You got the one that the God would be happy with." Because they get to choose which bull first. And so they build their altar, and they've done everything according to their rules and regulations. The only thing they can't do is they can't ignite the fire under the sacrifice. So verse 26, they took the bull that was given them, and they prepared it, and called upon the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, "Oh, Baal, answer us." So this contest evidently starts at about 9 a.m. in the morning. And I think that Elijah picks that time because that's when the morning sacrifice is supposed to be offered at the temple in Jerusalem. So this may, in fact, be the normal worship times for the Baal worshipers as well. Mid-morning, mid-afternoon. So he lets them go on for 3 hours, begging their God to shoot lightning down to this sacrificial altar. And the images that we have of Baal from the Middle East around this time, he's kind of holding a lightning bolt, getting ready to throw it down onto planet Earth. So they teach in their religion that that's what he can do. And yet he doesn't do it. The verse goes on to say, "But there was no voice." See, not even a sound of a lightning bolt, no thunder. "And no one answered." And so they limped around the altar that they'd made. And there's the dance step that they're doing, the slide, slide, jump, slide, slide, jump, something like that. At noon, so midday, the sun is directly overhead, Elijah mocked them. Now, the reason he's mocking them is to highlight the fact that they do not serve a real God. So he mocked them, saying, "Cry louder! He is a God." Either he's musing, and I told you, I think the Septuagint translation here represents the Hebrew word well, and it's the idea of chatting. Maybe he's chatting with someone, you know, he's distracted. Or he's relieving himself. Now that's the English Standard Version. The other English Bibles go with something similar. The literal Hebrew is turn aside. And so the English translators have assumed, and I think incorrectly, that it means turned aside to go to the bathroom in a private spot. The Septuagint, which is the Greek Old Testament, translated from Hebrew into Greek by those Jewish people who spoke both languages with excellence, they went with a word that means negotiating a business deal. So they saw turning aside meaning he's busy with a business transaction. And so I think that's the way we should see it. Either he's chatting, or maybe he's in a business transaction, or maybe he's on a journey. Or perhaps he's asleep and he must be awakened. You know how gods are. They're busy with stuff. And when they're not busy, they got to rest up. So you've got to get their attention. And so that's when they jacked up, you know, put higher their attempts to get Baal to respond. They cried aloud. They cut themselves after their custom with swords and lances until the blood gushed out upon them. So blood sacrifices have always been the standard since the very beginning of sinful humanity. Without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sin available. So blood sacrifices have always been the standard in religion. But in this case, they decide they need to add their own blood to the blood of the sacrifice to show how serious they are. So they're cutting themselves, not fatally, but enough that they can add to the sacrifice their own blood. And as midday passed, they raved on, meaning they kept on doing their crying aloud, their offering of their blood, and their dancing steps and all of that until the time of the offering of the oblation. And that's a clear reference to the mid-afternoon sacrifice at the temple in Jerusalem, sometimes referred to as the evening sacrifice. It happens when the sun is halfway down from noontime to the horizon. So it's about 3 o'clock is what we're going to call it, 3 o'clock afternoon. So that means another 3 hours passes for a total of 6 hours that Elijah gives them to get their god Baal to shoot some fire from the sky on their sacrifice. But there was no voice. No one answered. No one paid attention. And the reason for that is there is no god named Baal in reality. Now, there might be a demonic entity, a fallen angel, that goes around pretending to be this entity. But if that's the case, then God has supernaturally stopped that fraudulent being from sending fire at this time. And God's point is, I'm the only one. I'm the only real God. I'm the only God of rain and grain. So now Elijah clinches the deal. At God's direction, Elijah said to the people, "Come near to me." So it's my turn. Everybody, come over here to me. All the people came near to him, and he repaired the altar of He Who Is that had been thrown down. And so, as I said, we are a little over 70 years into the divided kingdom period, and the northern kingdom has established a twisted faith of the God who brought them out of Egypt, and they were worshiping him by means of golden calves at Bethel and Dan. And during some of the period of this alternate worship, the border has been closed forcibly between northern Israel and southern Judah, so that true worshipers that remained in northern Israel could not make the journey 3 times a year to Jerusalem to offer sacrifices. And so apparently at the leading of prophets like Elijah, the 100 other prophets that are in hiding thanks to Obadiah, at their leading, they have erected sacrificial altars inside the northern kingdom for authentic worship. This is an exception to the rule that God has granted. And so that altar, this one in particular, was up on Mount Carmel. Now, where exactly on Mount Carmel? We don't know. This is a ridgeline that stretches from the little bump on the Mediterranean coast of Israel near the modern city of Haifa. It stretches for 20-some miles to the southeast, down I think past Megiddo is where technically this ridgeline ends. And so there's a lot of places that this altar could have been. The high point on this ridge is almost 1,800 feet above sea level, and that's about 6 miles northwest of the city of Jokneum, which is itself about 7 miles northwest of Megiddo. So that's a possibility, that it was put on the highest place. But there are plenty of other places that could easily be serve as a convenient spot of worship to the true and living God for the true worshipers of God in this area. But we decided, or what we've discovered here, is that this altar during the time of Jezebel has been torn down because she has decided nobody's worshiping anyone except my God and goddess, Baal and Asherah. And so she apparently had this altar torn down, and so Elijah puts it back in place in front of the people. Verse 31, Elijah took 12 stones according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of He Who Is came, saying, Israel shall be your name. So the Old Testament, the books of Moses, said that if you're going to build an authorized altar to God somewhere, it has to be made of uncut stones. So Elijah takes 12 uncut stones from this place on Mount Carmel, puts them together, and then lays some wood on top of that and butchers the animal that is left, the sacrificial great animal that's left, and puts it up on this altar. Verse 32, with the stones he built an altar in the name of He Who Is, and he made a trench about the altar as great as it would contain 2 seahs of seed. Now, 2 seahs is about half of a bushel basket worth of seed. Think of 7 2-liter bottles full of wheat seed. So that's how much seed we're talking about. Now, what is being described here? Well, apparently, they could approximate how much seed would fill a furrow that had been dug in a field to grow grain later in the year. And so they knew about how much seed would fit into so much of a furrow. So what they're saying is, this is the length of furrow that he dug around the altar that he has built. And now how deep it is, we don't know. Probably not super deep. And we don't even know how wide it is necessarily. But for them, they would have had an estimate in their head as to what this would have looked like. Now, what's he doing? He's basically made a moat around his altar. Verse 33, he put the wood in order, cut the bull in pieces, laid it on the wood. And then he said, fill 4 jars with water. Now, we don't know how big these jars are. We don't even know where they got the water from. Remember, a drought is on. There might have been some artesian wells, which are deep source wells that might have still been running that they could have got water from. They might have carried water up from whatever remaining pools of water were in the Kishon River that runs down at the base of this ridge on the northeast side of it. Or maybe the Mediterranean is a few miles away. They could have brought salt water up, I suppose, for this particular purpose. But wherever they got it, he tells them to dump first 4 jars of water on top of the burnt offering and on the wood. So he's drenching it. And then he said, do it a second time. So that's 8 times. And then they did it a second time. And they said, do it a third time. So that's what? 12 big jars of water have been poured out on this 12-stone altar, soaking the wood, making it very hard to ignite, and soaking the sacrifice. And there was so much water that the water ran around the altar and filled the trench also with water. So there's enough excess from the drenching of the sacrifice in wood that it has formed a little reservoir, little moat around the sacrificial area. By all physical reality rules, this thing should not light. It should be free of fire getting a start in it. And that's Elijah's point. He wants to make it exceptionally clear this is God stuff that's about to happen. Verse number 36. And by the way, the symbolism is reminding them that they're all part of the original Israel, of 12 sons of Jacob, who was the son of Isaac, who was the son of Abraham, who had been told by God, in your seed, Abraham, all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed. So this is a reminder of their heritage. Verse 36. At the time of the offering of the oblation, so at the exact same time that the sacrifice is being offered in Jerusalem, on the authorized altar, at the authorized temple, by the authorized priests, in the kingdom of Jehoshaphat, who has brought the southern kingdom of Judah back to a good, healthy, right relationship with God. So at the exact same moment that they're worshiping down here in Jerusalem, this is what's happening 60-some miles away on Mount Carmel. At the time of the offering of the oblation, Elijah the prophet came near and said. Now, he doesn't start screaming like the Baal worshippers did. He's not cutting himself. And he doesn't have to spend 6 hours begging for God to send fire. His prayer is simple and to the point, and I think it's actually part of the teaching process here to let the Israelis watching this know a relationship with God is very simply a relationship with the God of the universe. He doesn't have to be prompted. He doesn't have to be primed like a pump. He doesn't have to be begged and pleaded with. He is listening and hears your prayers. So he came and he said, "Oh, he who is God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel," or Jacob. So the heritage is being brought out here again. "Let it be known this day that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and that I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O he who is, answer me that this people may know that you, O he who is, are God, and that you have turned their hearts back." That's a very simple prayer. God, show them that you're real. Show them that you're the only one. And demonstrate to them that I'm representing you so that they'll listen. And then, verse 38, and I love this part. "Then the fire of he who is fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood," and that's normal. Sacrifices burn, the fire burns up the wood and burns up the offering. But in this case, it also burned up the stones and the dust, and it licked up the water that was in the trench. When I tell this story, I like to say, when God was done with sending his fire, there was nothing left but a smoking hole in the ground. Even the stone altar was gone, vaporized. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and said, "He who is, he's God. He who is, he's God." And they start shouting out the name of he who is in Hebrew. Because the contest was all about which one of these two gods, Baal or he who is a real God. The God who answers by fire is clearly the winner and the true God. And that has been demonstrated without any doubt in front of these people's faces. And so they are down on the ground, naming the name, and basically coming back to the true faith. Now Elijah said to them, "Seize the prophets of Baal, let not one of them escape." And I'm guessing they also grabbed the prophetesses or prophets of Asherah as well. And so they seized them, they basically arrested them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and slaughtered them there. So they left the hill, they went down to the northeast somewhere, because that's where this river runs, is along the northeast border of this ridgeline. And there they executed these guys as false prophets because their God did not come through. And so then Elijah said to Ahab, which I'm guessing Ahab is very frustrated because this has all gone wrong for him. It's gone very badly. He never expected these things. And it's out of control. The people are the ones who are moving with Elijah at this point to execute his prophets and any prophetesses that might have been part of the group. So Elijah said to Ahab next, "You go up, eat and drink, for there is a sound of the rushing of rain." And so Ahab went up to eat and to drink. Now, where's he going? He's heading to Jezreel, which is one of his palaces away from the capital city of Samaria. Apparently, it becomes the place that he enjoys being in the most. Unfortunately, we've run out of time to talk any more about this story today, but you just mark your place right here in God's Word, and tomorrow we'll get right back into it with more of the story.